From the shadows of history to the present day, cult leaders have captured the imagination of the public, often leaving us bewildered as to how seemingly ordinary individuals could amass such devoted followings. But the truth is, the techniques they employed to manipulate and control their followers are as intricate as they are disturbing.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Haunted Detective Podcast. As you might have noticed, that wasn't me talking, which means it's time for Psychology with Pam, an episode where we take our season's topic and Pamela deep dives with you guys into psychology, the mind, and all things of the sort. So without further ado, I'm your favorite host, Kelsey Childs, but everyone calls me the paranormal Sherlock Holmes.
And I'm your favorite skeptic, Pamela J.
We just wanted to issue a bit of a content warning. This podcast episode discusses sensitive topics such as trauma, violence, and sexual abuse, specifically against some children. So listener discretion, yet again, is advised.
Well, Kelsey, in today's episode, what do you think we're unraveling today?
I'm going to pretend like I'm not reading your document right now. We are probably looking into the psychology behind the concept of cult and how people fall into line with someone claiming to be a prophet who is very obviously not to the outside world, but to their followers, maybe not so much.
Yes. So we're going to dive into the allure of a cult leader. We're going to examine their tactics and see how they exploit vulnerabilities of others through in-depth analysis and expert insights. We're going to uncover the underlying mechanisms of persuasion, indoctrination, and coercion that enabled these leaders to establish their dominion over the minds and hearts of their followers. And while these cults seem to be pretty outlandish and old, as a lot of the cults that we've talked about and the well-known cults are from the 50s and 60s and 70s, cults are actually very much alive today. So Kelsey, my question to you is, how many cults do you believe are active today in the U.S.?
Are we just talking about paranormal cults, or are we like including some of these like polygamy cults?
Yes. So any cult, anything from a religious cult, a sex cult, a doomsday cult, a polygamy cult, any type of cult.
Man, it's probably over 1,000 because you would think it's like a couple hundred, but mm-hmm. I know there's going to be a fucking scary face around the corner.
you know? Yes. So interesting enough, Margaret T. Singer, a professor of psychology out of the University of California at Berkeley, estimated that there are 2,500 to 3,000 cults in the United States, quote, Damn. With dozens of small cults too numerous to keep track of. The number of cult members nationally is variously estimated at 300,000 to 3 million.
3 million?
Yeah. It's a number that I don't think people would ever think of.
So some of these cults, I'm guessing, we don't know about. We're just kind of...
It's like a guesstimation. So there's so many tiny ones that we just don't really know about. And because there are large ones that range from 2,500 to 3,000, we're just guesstimating that there's so many little ones. In fact, according to Robin Boyle at St. John's School of Law, she talks about how the average length of one's stay in a cult has more than doubled. In the 1970s, the average term was 2.7 years. In contrast with the more recent statistic of 6.7 years. Moreover, the average age of the cult member went from 21 to 24. An example of this would be the Manson cult, as everybody knows, and Charles' followers were in their late teens to early 20s. So, I mean, they targeted a pretty young age range, but I found a commonality that they targeted people in their 20s, mostly.
That's interesting.
But I wanted to preface this episode by saying that cults are formed not because followers are insane or disoriented or crazy. They form because there are people who have the desire to have a meaningful life. They want a secure and purposeful life. And unfortunately, they just get tangled up in cult life.
That's, I mean, these cult leaders, from what we heard and looked into, they are very good at making people feel special. So it makes sense.
And what better than to target an age range that's known for having a lot of vulnerabilities?
Especially in the 70s. I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, specifically, I would say in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a lot of, I guess, instances of teenagers running away from home.
Yeah. There was one cult survivor that was talking about her experience on YouTube, and she said that it happened during the 70s. And that there was just a big, she called it like a hippie thing, where people were just like very free and they just did whatever they wanted. And that cults were just very alive back then more. So it's just a weird thing to think about, that in the 70s, there were just a bunch of cults.
I'd love to say it's weird. I'd love to say it's weird, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the 1970s, I mean, all of the years you listed, right? From the 50s to the 70s and even to the 90s, there wasn't any discipline, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Okay. I mean that with children vaguely. Like, yes, children got hit more back then. Yes, there was more domestic violence back then.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to letting kids wander around by themselves, like on the streets, in the yard, like, oh, here my two-year-old toddler who can barely walk, take this $1 and go buy candy from the store 2 miles away. It bred such a culture that it just doesn't surprise me at this point.
Yeah, no, seriously. And in that time, now Jonestown was in the 70s, and so was Manson, was around the similar time. He might have been a little bit later, I think. But so we know of these types of cults because they have this massive, they've been televised, they've been interviewed. So we know of the Manson family cult. We know of Jonestown. A lot of people know of David Koresh, from Waco, that cult leader. Most, if not all of these cults, they can be put into three pretty major categories. And just to, trigger warning, this is where we're going to talk about briefly of some pretty intense subjects. So the first category are religious cults. An example of this, while controversial, but some believe Scientology is a religious cult. Scientology is described as a network of interconnected corporate entities and other organizations dedicated to the promotion, management, and spreading of Scientology. Scientology is described in different ways, including as a cult, but some prefer to call it a commercial enterprise or a religious movement.
Religious movement, my ass. I've
honestly,
actually...
That was such a weird one. I thought like, oh, commercial enterprise.
I've never... Wait, I want to look up Scientology because I've never...
It's a weird looking building too. It's that blue with all the windows and the massive white letters that just say Scientology on the front of it.
Oh God, the website is just bizarre.
It is really scary.
Have you been on the website?
I unfortunately have. it looks like a place that you would walk into and never leave. A lot of celebrities are in Scientology as well.
So Scientology basically has nothing to do with science.
No, it doesn't. And that's the weird part about it. That's why they describe themselves as a commercial enterprise or a religious movement, because it's considered a new age religion.
Would you say that Scientology could be like in a... Could you say that Scientology is possibly the first example of a mega church?
Honestly, maybe. Because I think it's what... I think it depends on what people think a mega church is, because a lot of people would say a mega church is basically a business that is operating under a guise of a religion or a church, but is actually just a money-making machine rather than a house of God or something or other. So maybe, because personally, when I hear mega church, I just think of like a place that's using religion as like a guise. You know what I mean? What is your definition of a mega church?
Big fucking church that has no reason being that
so just
big,
a big with building. That
many fucking theatrics. Like, have you seen? I saw this one really disturbing video. It was after the Barbie movie. This freaking pastor at a mega church, he took a baseball bat and started like smashing a Barbie house or something.
Why? Was he pissed at the movie?
Not to get off topic or be like controversial at all, but like, fuck it, I'm just gonna say it. I think the reason why, I saw this video on TikTok. It was this gay guy, right? And he was saying people don't hate gay men.
They hate femininity.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I was like, same one.
Oh, that's so third wave feminism. But yeah, it's literally just people hate femininity. It's wild.
On that same video, there was a comment that really made me think. And it was, well, that's why my homophobic father didn't hate Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, why would he? But Neil Patrick Harris is an openly gay man. And then I realized that Neil really didn't come off as feminine. He came off as fairly masculine. And so they're like, well, he doesn't count. And I'm like, that's so fucked. Like, okay. Thanks for like hating most people then.
This is so off topic, but it's like, yeah.
Off topic, but you know.
I mean, it's relevant in churches because look at, not all churches, sorry, I didn't mean to say that. And a lot of cults and a lot of very aggressive religious movements, women have to cover up, but men don't. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes hand in hand with it. But anyway, sorry.
No, you're fine. So the next type of cult we're going to talk about are sex cults. A sex cult is similar to the Kid Welly sex cult. The Kidwell sex cult was a cult that operated out of the Welsh town of Kidwell. They went by the name of The Church, and the leader, Colin Bately, used psychological torture to force children into performing sexual acts. This cult, in short, was a child rape cult. In 2011, Bately and three female members were convicted and jailed.
How many members were there?
So the members were the ones who were convicted. It was Colin Bately and those three female members. At least that's just what we can find so far.
So it's basically his way of openly being a pedophile.
Yeah, I mean, he operated it out of his home. So it was just really fucked up. Like there's no way else to say it. It was just absolutely fucking disgusting. The other form of cult is something that a lot of people read into, and they're called doomsday cults. An example of a doomsday cult would be one that just recently happened, and once again, a trigger warning. February 6th, 2024, a Kenyan cult leader named Paul McKenzie and 29 associates were charged with the murder of 191 children.
Jesus.
The bodies of the children were discovered in a forest. The cult was called the Good News International Church. It was located in an 800-acre area with the Shakola Forest. More than 400 bodies were exhumed. Prosecutors say McKenzie ordered his followers to starve themselves and their children to death so that they could go to heaven before the world ended. They say it was one of the world's worst cult-related disasters in recent history. So this is really on a similar level of something we haven't seen since Jim Jones. And I felt it was really important to talk about it because it's happening now, currently.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
400. I mean, you can't compare tragedies, right?
No, but of course not. But
starving themselves makes what Jim Jones had his followers do look like child's play. Like, that's horrific.
Yeah. So, and the 400 bodies, at least from what I read, that was excluding the 191 children. So, I mean, there's more bodies that could be discovered. And the prosecutors, needless to say, I can't even fathom like having to read and look at all of these crime scene photos and just knowing that these children had no choice. And it's just, it's crazy. And like I said, this is unraveling. So if you guys want to keep, keep informed on this case, you absolutely can. It's all over the news. I know some people probably haven't heard about it. I know I haven't. So when I found this, Yeah. So when I found this, it was just like a gut punch that this is still happening today.
It's called the Good News International Church. There's nothing good about this cult.
Yeah, I thought that was such an odd name, the Good News International Church.
Well, it's inviting. It's welcoming. You know, it's, oh, you come here and you get something positive.
So unfortunately, I think it's safe to say that cult life is alive. But why though? Why do people join cults? Counseling psychologist Dominica Cani was able to find 5 key reasons why someone might join a cult. So Kelsey, what, other than the obvious, what do you think, and pretend you're not reading the document, why do you think an individual, just a regular average Joe that's in their 20s, might join a cult?
Well, I know I touched upon this briefly last episode, but for me, my perspective is it's no different than getting stuck in an abusive relationship. It's no different than having an addiction to a drug. It's no different than falling for a scammer because you want to believe that suddenly all this money is coming to you, right? It's, you know, I see cult leaders as scam artists. They're really, really, really good at love bombing, manipulation, gaslighting, and basically making someone feel worthless without them. And that's what a con artist does, right? You know?
Yeah. And it's interesting you touched on love bombing because we're going to get into that later.
But I definitely didn't read that.
But let's get into reason number one. Desire for a better life. The desire to have a better life can ensnare individuals into joining a cult. Often, cults masquerade as a self-help organization, offering appealing advantages. Founders of such cults prey on those who are vulnerable and eager for a better life amid life's trials. During the recruitment phase, potential members are lured in with incomplete details, along with promises of enhancing their lifestyle. Throughout this process, followers of the cult employ psychological tactics to trawl in individuals striving for a better, yet often unattainable, way of life. Reason number two, source of identity. A cult provides companionship, networking opportunities, and a substitute for an extended family structure. The organization represents a resilient, flourishing, and devoted community, presenting an ideal solution for individuals grappling with societal integration. Membership in a cult grants individuals a feeling of significance, belonging, and diminishes feelings of vulnerability. Members forge strong emotional, social, and psychological connections that are challenging to sever. It's typical for families to permanently lose contact with any relatives who become involved with the cult, similar to what we saw in Jonestown when Jim Jones isolated all of his members when he moved them to the jungle. Number three, desperation or severe lack. Many individuals are drawn to cults as a response to difficulties or a profound absence of love, empathy, or a sense of belonging. The longing for a clearly defined and secure life can render these individuals vulnerable to manipulative movements. Charismatic cult leaders foster emotional, physical, and psychological reliance by overwhelming followers with affection, solace, and understanding they crave through a technique known as love bombing.
Love bombing.
Number four, traumatic experiences. The timing of recruitment into a cult holds significant importance. Convincing a rational and clear-minded individual to join a group is extremely challenging. However, it's a breeze to manipulate someone who is experiencing vulnerability due to a difficult circumstance or circumstances. Individuals undergoing traumatic events like divorce are particularly susceptible to manipulation. as noted by Rachel Bernstein, a specialist in cults, many survivors admit, quote, I wouldn't have joined the cult if I hadn't been going through a tough life experience at that time, end quote. And number five, emotional love bombing. Cult recruiters target individuals who are emotionally distressed, under pressure, or facing hardships, and employ a tactic known as love bombing. Love bombing involves the manipulation of emotions and psychology through exaggerated praise and attention. A cult member may befriend and offer support to the vulnerable individual in order to gain their trust. Subsequently, the victim is deceived into joining the group with promises of finding solutions to their problems.
It's an abusive relationship. I mean, if you strip it down to its core, it's an abusive relationship. I mean, how do people get sucked into dating a partner that doesn't necessarily pass their litmus test, right?
Right. Which I know we talked about that a little bit at the end of last episode, where yeah. I was like, when I get into all this, you guys are going to all realize like, oh, so they're narcissists. Like,
no, these people literally.
Are literally narcissists. And it's crazy because you might know a narcissist. You probably do.
Okay. So we have desire for a better life compared to an abusive relationship. It's the making plans for the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're promising you a better life. We're going to go on this vacation. We're going to buy this ring. I'm going to get you these flowers. Source of identity. That one's obvious. You're gaining a partner, a life partner, someone to make decisions with, spend time with, right?
Mm-hmm. And they separate you from your family.
Exactly. Desperation or severe lack. Pretty much love bombing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's that same promises, traumatic experiences, narcissists and abusive partners know how to trauma bond with people,
mm-hmm.
just like cult leaders do, or kind of exploit vulnerabilities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Emotional love bombing usually comes later into a relationship when you're like, oh, I can't leave. This person's going to kill themselves or kill me or do this, this or that.
No, 100%. But what's interesting is that it's a specific type of narcissist.
And malignant.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't even read that. I just already knew. I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. You're right. So Dr. Bernstein also said that cult leaders have a very specific personality called malignant narcissism. And they're people who have sociopathy and simply don't give a fuck about the pain they inflict, the damage they cause, and the lives that they derail in order to get their very powerful ego needs met.
So I have a question, and I know we can talk about this a little bit, but how does malignant narcissism, I know it's somewhere in between, right? It's a violent narcissistic person, someone who will get violent, hurt other people, hurt themselves, etc., when they don't get their needs met. But
yeah.
So for those of you who don't know, narcissism is, it's a shield, right? It's a spiky Bowser shell. When someone gets hurt so immensely in their life or they get rejected, dejected, something happens through their developmental years, they kind of form this spiky shell around them. And that's narcissism.
Yes.
But you're saying that in malignant narcissism, sociopathy and that shield or shell, they kind of go hand in hand. What is, like, why aren't they just called antisocial personality people? You know, why is it malignant narcissism?
So the reason why it's malignant narcissism is because this is when someone has a severe inflated sense of self-worth, which someone who's antisocial most likely doesn't share those same characteristics. In fact, it's usually the opposite. So malignant narcissists, the sociopathy part of that is that they want admiration and they need admiration and they don't care how they get it. So they want the attention. They want that ego boost. When someone who's antisocial, they don't need an ego boost.
So would it be sociopathy or like psychopathy almost?
Well, so
I know this wasn't, I know we're neither of us are doctors.
No. So a really good a really good thing about this is, so psychopaths have a more paranoid stance. So they're more unwilling to even internalize the values of the aggressor, while malignant narcissists have the capacity to admire powerful people. So you know how malignant narcissists, they're most likely going to be the ones that are like, Hitler knew what he was doing. Hitler was able to talk to people. Hitler this, Hitler that. Or Charles Manson was able to get followers. Jim Jones was able to get followers. While a psychopath is like, well, no one's going to be better than me.
So the narcissist still has emotions, but they're kind of bordering on the edge of cold, emotionless demon. Oh, it actually, like, literally combines narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah. But separately, they're two different things. So it's like a common, it's really fascinating and kind of scary.
It's like, because sociopathy can also be caused by trauma and your brain not developing correctly. It's like the people who didn't exactly get to the sociopathy point, they're still in the narcissism realm, but they're almost there. They're almost there.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's scarier. It's like...
Well, yeah. So a malignant narcissist is a complete combination of a narcissist and a psychopath.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fucking scary. Like, it's really scary.
Kind of like Andrew Jackson, right?
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Jackson could be an example of a malignant narcissist.
Malignant narcissists are also known to be very sadistic. They genuinely don't feel their actions. They don't understand. Like, they don't care to understand that they've hurt you physically. I mean, they could literally do something so grotesque and awful to you, they won't feel a thing.
So technically, Ted Bundy is not a sociopath. He's actually a malignant narcissist. Saddam Hussein, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Nasser, those are all, through psychological profiles, they were considered malignant narcissists. Gaius Julius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, his full name, his legal name on there. Julius Caesar, damn.
Oh, I heard, here, listen to this. So a malignant narcissist will display traits such as arrogance, a need for recognition, and tendencies to use or exploit others for selfish reasons. Malignant narcissism is used to describe those with symptoms of both narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder.
Bro, I'm so sorry. Vlad the Impaler, so Vlad the Third, Prince of Wallachia, the man that Bram Stoker's Dracula is based off of.
Yeah.
He is considered a malignant narcissist, which is insane to me because of the shit that he did.
I also think that most evil people that we know of, like maybe Bundy, I think would be considered a malignant narcissist. But then again, I don't know.
That's actually his diagnosis, is malignant narcissism.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because he was definitely a narcissist, but I'm not a psychologist. Like, we're just two girls with a lot of research.
One's going to get her psychology degree. But
yeah, okay. I was like, I have my criminal justice degree, but you know, we're chilling.
Ted Bundy is a really good example of malignant narcissism because, okay, I don't want to bring up the popular ones. I hate calling them that. But
yeah, I get that.
Take Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Or actually take John Wayne Gacy versus Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy was able to woo a crowd. He was able to turn people in his favor to the point where people nowadays are still questioning if he's guilty or not. That is the difference between malignant narcissism and sociopathy, where these other serial killers like Richard Ramirez, Jeffrey Dahmer, they could not woo a crowd. People were instantly disgusted by them.
Yes, 100%. That's a really good example.
Boom! I'm going to ace my psychology quiz. Wait, is there a quiz at the end of this?
I can make one.
Bet. We should make a Quizlet for the podcast.
Oh, that would be really, I would love that. That's so fun. But so with this, we know why a person might join a cult, and we know kind of in the head of what type of person we're looking for that might become a cult leader. But how are the leaders of these cults using this to their advantage? So, Dr. Henderson at Walden University discussed just that in her 2023 dissertation. Now, just a warning, this is a lot of information. So, quote, psychological manipulation, also known as brainwashing, where they would inflict psychological and physical cruelty among individuals at varying intensities. The method is a way someone gains control over another person, changes their ideology and belief system. Master manipulators are excellent at pushing boundaries to get someone to trust them completely. Cult leaders use the FFM traits to embolden their manipulation tactics, so they become masters. For those who might not know what FFM traits means, FFM are the big five personality traits, which are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeable, neuroticism.
So wait, really quick, what, because a lot of people might not know, I guess, the technical terms for these. I mean, we all know what an extrovert is. What else could you call this, I guess, these traits?
So openness is curiosity. Conscientiousness means you're hardworking. Extroversion, outgoing. Agreeable means you're very helpful. And neuroticism is an anxious tendency. So master manipulators can tap into different personas to apprehend someone's mind. In a publication in Psychology Today, in response to the recent conviction of NXIVM cult leader Keith Raniere, highlights manipulators do not act quickly, but take their time with their manipulation tactics. Individuals capable of manipulating are comfortable engaging in taboo behavior to effectively manipulate.
Okay. So this is, I call this planting a seed, and mm-hmm. everyone always fucking looks at me like I'm crazy. And I've identified narcissists in like some of my friends' lives. And
yeah,
I've told them, like, you have to be careful with how you break off from these narcissists, because they plant seeds to like sow doubt in the people around them, right? So yeah. Basically these seeds, they water them over time. So they don't plant a tree, they don't plant a bush or a flower, they plant a seed. And then slowly over time they water it. And this might look like me coming up to you, and let's say we had a mutual friend and her name was Amanda. And I knew that Amanda saw through my guise of being a narcissist, hypothetically, right? Mm-hmm. And I went up to you and I was like, I don't know, dude. Amanda, I just get like kind of like weird around her. I don't know what it is, but... Or the next time I go up to you and I say, yeah, my dog was growling at Amanda today. It was so weird. I don't know why that would happen. My dog never growls at anyone. And I keep going with those little teeny tiny things. And eventually you're going to start to doubt Amanda.
Yeah.
Even if we're all equally friends, right? No one's closer than the other one. We're a friend group. Even if you know Amanda better than me, by the end of it, my goal would be, if Amanda ends her friendship with me, I use you as what one of my therapists called, and I love this, a flying monkey. And I send you out after her, because then you're on my side, because I've already grown a fucking tree in your brain.
That's a really good example. Well, I mean, and that just would then kind of isolate Amanda away from everybody else.
Absolutely.
Because they would all shun that friend. They would all shun Amanda.
Well, it wouldn't be meant for people to shun Amanda, because the narcissist, their goal is to punish this person, to punish them for not agreeing with the narcissist's reality. So people would stay in her, in Amanda's life, but in a really off sort of way. And I actually, I had this happen to me once with a friend, and obviously I'm not going to say any names. Sorry, I'm totally taking over the discussion, but I love talking about this.
No, it's, this is one of those things that I love when people have, let me rephrase, because I don't love that people are able to associate with dealing with narcissistic people, but I do like that people are able to talk about it. And it provides a safer spot for people to be like, ah, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that, like, this person was just like dropping seeds and like really like exhibiting narcissistic behavior. And like, well, now I'm a little nervous. And while I'm, and so it's good to have these conversations. It's good to relate this to things in your life because you could be helping somebody else.
No, it's so true. So I had a friend when I lived in California. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to realize, you know, I'm so aware of this stuff. I've been so therapized in my life, but I still feel victim to it, right?
Yeah.
And this person, you know, she mean girled me.
What the fuck?
Not in the way that you expect. We would meal prep together and she was putting shit in my food to make me gain weight.
What?
Yeah. And she was slowly trying to convince me that my cat hated me. She would try to set me up with guys. And then when they actually were attracted to me or wanted to go out with me, she would get mad at me and then have a whole discussion like, oh, I don't want to like feel like I'm fighting with my best friend over men. And I'd be so confused because I would say, well, you set me up with him.
Yeah, you're like, what the fuck?
And I double checked with you like 17 times, but there was a whole lot of stuff that happened. But by the end of it, I ended up losing 3 very close friends of mine. And I can't say for sure if all of them were because of this person, but one of them definitely was because she ended up texting me like this long, like page long paragraph. And this is normally someone that was very grounded, very down to earth. Mm-hmm. And she started hanging out with this person. And suddenly I get this long, long text message basically accusing me of lying about my trauma and exaggerating things. And there's something always wrong with you. And I'm looking at this person's story and these two people, they're now constantly hanging out. And this once very down to earth girl is now like wine drunk every afternoon. And, you know, it just was bizarre to me. But that was when I learned what a flying monkey was because I brought that text message into my therapist.
Yeah.
And of course I was like, okay, there's some stuff I have to work on, right? But
yeah,
my therapist was like, no, that's called a flying monkey. This friend of yours, anonymous, didn't get her way. She wasn't able to control you or manipulate you. So she sent people out after you, people that she had been planting seeds in their heads with, right?
Yeah.
But anyways, that's one of many stories in my life.
That's fucking horrendous, Kelsey.
It is. I still have the text message.
Oh my God.
Let me see if I can find it. Oh yeah, I still have it.
Oh my God. So the most common manipulation tactic used by cult leaders includes physical isolation as a method to maintain control over their devotees. So an example of this would be Jonestown. Also using mind-altering drugs to manipulate their followers into believing the messages they were speaking. So that's an example of Charles Manson. These manipulation processes used by cult leaders can be described as narcissistic, as it feeds into their cult leader's grandiose sense of self while also being revered as a godlike being amongst their followers. Cult leaders also use psychological manipulation to retain and recruit members, and it is an essential method for the cult to be successful. A common method of manipulation used by cult leaders is preying upon the fears of their followers as well as their desires to be a part of something greater. The chameleon-like behavior of cult leaders is essential to developing their psychological manipulation tactics, and cult leaders are masters of making them appear a certain way to a target audience. Furthermore, Once cult leaders are able to give an individual what they need, so that could be personally, emotionally, or even spiritually.
Or sexually.
There's a transformation of, yeah, sometimes even sexually. And with that, there's a transformation of perception. The process of manipulation is methodical because cult leaders also use their tactics to convince their followers that they have free will and free thought. Cult followers have difficulty separating from the cult environment due to the indoctrination process of cult leaders changing their followers' ability to think for themselves. Cult leaders use narcissistic seduction to entice cult commitment. The process is multidimensional, it's time-consuming, and often circulates around the vulnerability of the individuals based upon emotions, isolation, propaganda, and inclusion within the organization. The result of this process is that the new cult member loses their ability to think freely, creating a high-level dependence on the cult leader. And with all of those things in mind and combined, that's how cult leaders get cult followers. And just to wrap this up with a little bit of a PSA, by remaining vigilant and questioning information presented to us, we can fortify ourselves against falling victim to the allure of charismatic yet deceitful figures. Moreover, our collective awareness and support networks serve as powerful defenses against the encroachment of cult-like ideologies. By fostering open dialogue, empathy, and education, we create environments where individuals are empowered to recognize and resist these abusive tactics. So, Kelsey, what are your thoughts on all this? And just like, do you think these tactics that cult leaders use were really surprising? Because they weren't really that surprising for me. And I know that you and I have spoken a lot about narcissistic people throughout history, as well as people that we've known throughout our lives.
It's not surprising to me. It's an abusive, narcissistic relationship, just on a greater scale. Actually, while you were wrapping that up, I was looking into databases and resources for cult survivors, and there really isn't a lot, because I was like, what can we offer?
Yeah.
How can we like help people?
So there is one that I did find that was super fascinating by Robin Boyle at the St. John's University School of Law, who I spoke about earlier. She has a whole publication on cult recovery, a clinician's guide to working with former members and family. But she was really the only one I could find that was an in-depth guide and dedication to people who are cult survivors. I know that there are some sociologists who were cult survivors themselves of polygamy cults who talk about their experiences and try to help others. But I mean, it's a very almost niche thing. Like we talk about victims and victims getting help. And I mean, even stalker victims getting help. And so we've been really, I mean, you and I have really been able to get a lot of support groups to offer, and even phone numbers to call if people need them, of hotlines. But for this one, it's a little disheartening that there's very little.
Yeah. I mean, there is also the National Association of Forensic Counselors, which I don't know the legitimacy of that, but it's www.forensiccounselor.org. But I would think
there's also Encourage.
Encourage?
So it's E-N Courage. So it's capital E, capital C. And it was an organization that's set up in order to offer support to those who have left a cult or an abusive group. And it's supposed to help those who were even born into cults.
I mean, there's the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is important to talk about, because so it's 1-800-799-SAFE, aka 1-800-799-7233. But the thing that I've heard about some of these hotlines, like I was watching some videos about people who have called the suicide hotline for legitimate help and have been turned away or rejected or told to just deal with it.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of makes me question the legitimacy of some hotlines and the legitimacy of their hiring process, I guess you could say, and training. But I don't know, there makes me sad that there isn't a resource for cult survivors.
Yeah, I mean, there's not one that I think at least is talked about enough. So for instance, we all have probably heard of the TV show like Escaping Polygamy. Really, that's all most people know of is that TV show where people are making money off of other people's stories.
I wonder what happens if you Google how to escape a cult.
I've never looked that up, if I'm being honest.
So there's something called exit counseling. It requires, this is from the New York Times. It requires persuasion by therapists, lawyers, friends, and family members. Try to get one-on-one time. Oh, this is how to get someone out of a cult.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Don't try to forcibly remove someone. This is an article by Malia Wolin in 2018. Basically, what people are saying is do everything to stay in touch. Like if you know someone that is, and this could go for narcissistic abuse too, do everything you can to stay in touch.
Yeah.
If you're, quote, if you're trying to persuade someone to leave a cult, supply reminders of the world beyond it by calling, emailing, writing letters, sending photographs, maybe even visiting. Although Yanja Lalik warns that anyone can get lured into a cult, you should visit, quote, only if you're feeling strong enough to resist, she says. Don't try to forcibly remove someone, even if you're gravely concerned. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, families often hired so-called deprogrammers to kidnap and hold cult members against their will. While that often worked, abduction is illegal. And the technique was discredited after a Washington man successfully sued his deprogrammer in 1995. Today's preferred method is exit counseling, and it requires persuasion by therapists, lawyers, friends, and family members. Try to get one-on-one time, and if you do, don't use it to harp. Instead, ask questions and make sure you've already collected anti-cult evidence like news articles or memoirs.
I also found this website that's called peopleleavecults.com.
Huh.
And People Leave Cults, it says, is proud to offer unique support groups for former cult members. Each support group offers former group members the opportunity to meet with mental health professionals and other former members in a safe virtual environment, and that these sessions are hosted by People Leave Cults in collaboration with licensed professionals.
Yeah, I'm on People Leave Cults, how to leave a cult. They have a step-by-step guide.
Yeah, it's crazy.
peopleleavecults.com/post/how-to-leave-cult.
I know that was a lot of information for this episode. A lot of manipulation, a lot of narcissists, a lot of abuse that we know of. So honestly, take a breather after this episode.
Jesus,
and honestly, after this season. I mean, it's been a pretty dark season. It's been a lot of episodes with a lot of heavy information. So try not to carry it with you throughout the day. And if this episode affected you negatively in any way, I very much apologize, but this is very important because cult life and cult survivors are a very real thing that are obviously still happening today. So just a reminder to take care of your brain. You only have one.
Yeah, I swear after this season, I mean, this was one of the hardest seasons to write, and we still have one more episode, which is purely discussion-based, but
yeah,
when, I'm not saying if, I'm saying when this podcast makes it big, I would love to start a nonprofit to help people get out of situations like cults or narcissistic relationships, because let's face it, a restraining order is worth less than the paper it's written on. I heard that on a TV show. I think it was Hawaii Five-0, and it was so fucking accurate.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but accurate.
I mean, if TV shows are saying it, then the fuck, but...
If a TV show is saying it, that means people can relate to it. And that's the bad part.
That is the bad part, yeah.
That's the bad one.
Without further ado, we're going to close the case file on cults for today. And we will see you back here next week, Monday at midnight. Don't miss out. And don't forget to leave us a nice review. Follow us on Instagram, haunted.detective. and say something nice. Tell us what you appreciate or don't appreciate. I mean, fan feedback, listener feedback, it's how we grow and how we find our voice eventually and do better. So, yeah.
Yeah. And tell us something that you maybe didn't know or something that you learned while you were listening or maybe something that you want us to talk about in the future.
We also just posted something today, which today would be March 29th while we're recording, on the Instagram asking people for recommendations of cold cases we can cover, because something I want to do is start talking about more cold cases on our season specials to spread awareness and help garner exposure for these missing or murdered people. So, oh, that's heavy. Without further ado, let's actually close the case file. So, we love you. We love you guys.
We love you guys.
Gonna take like a nap for 3 years.
Yeah, I'm taking a fat nap with some nice sleepy time tea and slippers.
Ooh, I'll join you there soon. I'm in your walls.
Oh, fantastic.
I was hoping you would say that. Knocking on all the walls. Kelsey.
Hello.
Ah, yes, that's me. Hi.
Ah, hey.
Hey.
Get out of there.
Get out of there, you silly goose.
Had to end it on a little bit of a higher note.
All right. Bye.